In September 1999, a group of apartment buildings around Moscow were bombed, and the attacks, which killed hundreds of civilians, were blamed on Chechen rebels. The Russian government's response, launching a second war in Chechnya, helped catapult a little-known parliament speaker named Vladimir Putin to the heights of Russian power. And 10 years after the attacks, questions remain about who was behind the bombings. And journalist Scott Anderson went to Russia to investigate. His article, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, appeared in the September issue of GQ magazine, but it's been alleged that Condé Nast buried the story and prevented it from being printed or publicized in Russia. And we are joined now by Mr. Anderson for today's underreported segment. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's start with the bombings themselves. Can you quickly sketch out the official timeline of events in 1999 and what of the points about him remain unanswered?
The first bombing was in early September, and it was a military barracks housing in southern Russia. And in quick, a truck bomb collapsed an entire building, killed about 90-some-odd people. And then in quick succession, over the next 12 days, there were three more bombings of apartment buildings each time, caused catastrophic collapse of each of the buildings.
Did anybody take credit for that?
No one ever took credit for it. But very quickly, after really the second bombing, the Russian government started making soundings that Chechen terrorists were behind it. And very quickly, a hysteria developed in Russia where Chechens were being stopped on the streets, that vigilantes were roaming around stopping any Chechen they saw. And just very, very quickly, it created this hysteria throughout the country.
Well, when Timothy McVeigh bombed the building in Oklahoma City, immediately there were suspicions that these were Muslim terrorists.
That's right.
But eventually the investigation proved that the story was something quite different. Is that not what happened in Russia? Just simply say Chechens and then keep it there?
Pretty much. The story kept changing, and then what the really interesting that happened. I guess the first question that was raised was when the country was in a state of high alert, and Chechens looked different than ethnic Russians. They're darker complected. How was it that this group or groups of Chechen terrorists were roaming the countryside, scoping buildings to do new bombings, carrying them out, and then getting away with it? That was the first question that some people had. And then shortly after the fourth bombing, actually just 2 days ago was the 10th anniversary, in a small town called Ryazan, east of Moscow, people living in an apartment building noticed two men carrying sacks down into the basement of their building and called the police, called the FSB, the law enforcement branch. And eventually the men were caught, and they turned out to be FSB agents, the Russian kind of the takeover from the old KGB. The Russian government then very quickly put out saying, oh, this was a training exercise. The sacks did not contain explosives, that they contained sugar, although the local FSB officers in Ryazan had already determined that it was explosives. And the very curious thing about the event in Ryazan is that was the last one. That very night that Ryazan happened, the Second Chechen War started. Russian warplanes started bombing Grozny, the Chechen capital, and the war was on. And the curious thing is that there was never another bombing.
Well, also there had been a report that a bombing had taken place in a city where it hadn't taken place.
That's
then,
right.
And then after the fact, then there was a bombing there.
That's
it was almost
right.
Like, oops, we reported the wrong bombing first.
That's right. The speaker of the Duma, the parliament speaker, got up in the middle of the Duma and said, I've just received a report that there has been a bombing in the city of Volgodonsk. And it turned out that there was a bombing that night, but it was another apartment building in Moscow. And then 3 days later, an apartment building in Volgodonsk was hit. And there's a great quote from one of the parliamentary members who tried to question the speaker and said, how did you tell us on Monday about a bombing that didn't happen until Thursday? And he had his microphone cut off.
All of this took place pretty much 10 years ago.
Yes.
In fact, the last bombing was September 22nd.
That's right.
1999. Now, we'll get more into the issue of what happened with Condé Nast later, but I'm curious as to why you think a major media organization would be interested in censoring its own story about this subject in Russia. Do they sell a lot of copies of The New Yorker and Vogue in Moscow and worry about having the sales affected?
That's my assumption. Actually, the Russian edition of GQ is a very popular magazine over there. I don't know. There are four Condé Nast publications in the Russian language. I don't know about the other ones. I believe there is Vogue also. I don't know how that sells, but I know that GQ is a very popular magazine there.
My guest is Scott Anderson. His article, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, appeared in the September issue of GQ magazine. And now it's been disappeared. The person at the heart of your story is a man named Mikhail Trepashkin. What kinds of jobs had he performed in the KGB and then in the FSB when the KGB became the FSB?
Trepashkin is a really fascinating character. He was a criminal investigator for the KGB, and actually his area of specialty was the smuggling of antiquities. So he was a criminal investigator as opposed to somebody more involved in espionage or counterintelligence. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he was one of the few KGB officers to only a fraction were able to keep their jobs. He moved over to the Russian version of the KGB, which eventually became named FSB.
And he was investigating Bank Soldi. Why?
Bank Soldi. He was involved in this very interesting case. What happened is in the early days of Russia, and I think you see it continuing on, is that the Chechen mafias have all the Chechens have sort of played the role of Sicilian mafias in this country. They've always been purported to control much of the underworld of the country. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, corruption was just endemic in the early years of Russia. There are all sorts of connections between Communist Party officials, soldiers, and with the Chechen mafia. And so when he investigated the Bank Soldi case, it was a gang, this is in the mid-90s, right when the first Chechen war had started. Basically, the Chechen mafias were funding the war effort in Chechnya. So this Bank Soldi case was basically kind of an elaborate sting operation to spread word to this Chechen organized crime group it was going to be a blackmail extortion campaign. And when the case finally broke, what they discovered was that all sorts of both Russian military and FSB officers were involved with the Chechen mafia.
So the Chechen mafia would have been opposed to Chechen independence because they were in bed with Russian officials.
No, the thing that's really remarkable about it is that this group was fundraising for the Chechen war effort. So for the Russian military, there was two generals involved, as well as for the FSB officers. They were basically colluding with a gang that was directly raising funds for a group that was fighting Russia. So in any country, that's treason.
What eventually happened to Trepashkin's investigation into Russian military collusion with a group that's linked to Chechen rebels?
He was taken off the case. He was taken off the case very quickly by senior people in the FSB. He resisted, and he was eventually forced out of the FSB altogether.
And who did the FSB decide to investigate instead?
Mikhail Trepashkin.
So he's out.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean he stops his investigation.
No, and what happened? When the 99 bombings occurred, he had retired. He had transferred over to the tax police. He really had no investigative role at the time of the bombings took place. But he very quickly became suspicious about the whole nature of the bombings.
My guest is Scott Anderson, whose article "None Dare Call It Conspiracy" was featured in the September issue of GQ magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another person in the story, somebody whose name most people will recognize, was former KGB agent Alexander Litvinenko, who'd been ordered to kill Trepashkin and Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky.
Berezovsky, yeah.
Do we know why the two men were targeted? Were they linked? Was Berezovsky linked to Trepeshkin?
Basically, when Trepeshkin wouldn't go quietly, when the FSB was trying to ease him out, people with high-ranking officers in the FSB approached Litvinenko, whose background was counterintelligence and counterterrorism. He was much more of an active field agent than Trepeshkin was. They approached him about assassinating Trepeshkin, and then subsequently to assassinate Boris Berezovsky, who at the time was a Russian oligarch. He was one of the wealthiest men in Russia.
So they were just two thorns in the side of the Russian leadership.
That's right.
And they wanted Litvinenko to kill both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Did he do that for a living? Go out and
No, he didn't. This is the very odd thing about it's very tricky when you can carry conspiracy theories too far. And my feeling when the people who have first approached Litvinenko. Everything was in such chaos at that time in Russia that it could have been Litvinenko's kill orders could have come from a mid-level FSB officer. They didn't necessarily come from the top command. And instead, what Litvinenko did, along with three of his fellow officers in the same unit who'd also been approached, they held a press conference. And
Trepeshkin showed up, didn't
he? And Trepeshkin showed up at the press conference. And Litvinenko said, I was ordered to kill Boris Berezovsky. I was ordered to kill Trepeshkin. And then subsequently, he went into exile.
And then those 1999 bombings occurred. And how did they intersect with the lives of Trepeshkin and Litvinenko?
What happened is by 1999, Litvinenko had gone taken asylum in England, and he was working with Boris Berezovsky, who had also gone into exile. Very quickly after the bombings took place and Putin was catapulted to power, Berezovsky and Litvinenko felt that really understanding what happened in those 99 bombings was a key to understanding the current Russian regime. They approached Trepeshkin because Trepeshkin was still in Russia. He had a background as a criminal investigator, and significantly, he had a law degree. And one of the little details of Russian law is that if you're a direct relative of a victim of crime, you can get access to the criminal records of the investigative files of the FSB. So a young woman from Wisconsin, whose mother had been killed in one of the bombings, had Trepeshkin come on as her lawyer. And through that, Trepeshkin was able to look at the FSB investigative files on the bombings.
Litvinenko suggested that Putin played a role in the bombings, and he was killed in 2006, after being given a lethal dose of polonium in London. There's a lot of ways that political dissidents have been silenced by regimes in the past, but polonium poisoning is not only rare, but also takes a relatively long and painful time to kill someone. So why kill Litvinenko in such a public and prolonged way?
My feeling, and a feeling of a lot of people, is that it was a message that was being sent that
they wanted to show that he was going to suffer before he died.
Yeah. I mean, either that, or they thought they were going to get away with it. That because polonium leaves the body fairly quickly, so I think what they were maybe hoping was that he would linger for a while from this very mysterious malady that no one would be able to figure out, and then he'd die, and it would just go sort of unexplained. But Litvinenko was certainly one of the most hated men at the time that he was killed within the Russian ruling hierarchy. He was seen as, he was a defector, which Trepeshkin had never been. And when you come from the KGB background and you leave the country, you're seen very much as a traitor. And Litvinenko was very indiscriminate in the accusations he made against Putin and about the people around Putin. So he had a lot of enemies.
Well, when you start accusing the head of the country of being implicated in these bombings, you're going to make enemies. But I don't know whether that means you're going to be assassinated.
Right.
Although there have been any number of assassinations of journalists. I wonder about your situation. I wonder about Trepeshkin. Have attempts been made on his life?
Not that I know of. Certainly not in the last couple of years, but he was, when as he became involved in pursuing this case, and when he came across some pretty damning evidence suggesting governmental collusion in the bombings, he was arrested on a pretty spurious charge and sent to prison for 4 years.
Now, people were arrested for the bombings in the city of Ryazan on September 22nd, 1999. What were they charged with? Is it likely that they were responsible?
The people who were picked up in Ryazan were never charged. They were let go. The two FSB, and it actually turned out there were three FSB officers in Ryazan at the time, a woman and two men. They were immediately released and have never testified, never been brought out in the public.
The government changed its account of the events.
Yes, they did. Excuse me. Yes, I mean the original with the Ryazan, with the I mean you call it a training exercise or a failed bombing. Very quickly when they realized that the city was when they. The local police were looking for these people, and they couldn't get out of the city. The story started to change, and then, of course, when they did get caught, then it was like, "Oh no, it's just a training exercise. We were just testing like local vigilance."
And then, after the Ryazan bombing, the bombing stopped.
The bombing stopped, which to me is really one of the most interesting details, because if the other bombings had been carried out by Chechens or any terrorist group that wanted
they would have
to,
kept on going.
Would have kept on going. And now you've the FSB has this public relations nightmare on their hand. So why would you ever stop then? Why wouldn't you keep going?
President Yeltsin had signed a peace accord with the Chechens in 1997. So why was Vladimir Putin, then the prime minister, allowed to order a second invasion of Chechnya?
This is where I think you really see the what happens in a society, and I don't think Russia is necessarily unique in this, where a war hysteria or a panic sets in. The fact is, in the past, the Chechen rebels are not, they're not Canadian peacekeeping troops. They've had a series of atrocities they've done in the past, and there's a very deep and historical animosity by most ethnic Russians towards Chechens, and they're willing to believe almost anything about Chechens. So when I think probably the vast majority of people, when the first bombing started, it made sense to them that the Chechens were behind it, leaving aside the fact that the Chechens had been given autonomy 2 years before. So what rationale, at least on any sort of organized or governmental level, what rationale would the Chechens have to be doing this?
Well, this sounds like a justification for going back to Chechnya for whatever reason. The same sort of thing we saw with the Gulf of Tonkin, right, and weapons of mass destruction in two wars that we got involved in.
Right. And Putin had been named, he was the third prime minister named in less than a year. He had been named 3 weeks before the first bombing. And his first approval ratings at the time, I believe it was in August or September, because there were upcoming presidential elections, he pulled 2%. And after the bombings, after the invasion of Chechnya, when the elections were held 5-6 months later, he won with 54%.
He went from being a newly appointed prime minister in August 1999 to the interim president in January 2000. That's a pretty quick ascent.
Yes.
Had Trepashkin crossed paths with Putin before at the FSB?
No, they had never met. Litvinenko and Putin knew each other quite well.
And once Putin was empowered, what happened to Trepashkin's investigation? Did he accelerate it? Did he think Putin had anything to do with this?
I think Trepashkin's such a careful criminal investigator. It's kind of interesting in seeing the difference in personality between him and Litvinenko. Litvinenko was pretty indiscriminate in his accusations. I think Trepashkin's he's kind of a born cop, and he's not going to make accusations unless he has the evidence to back it up. I think Trepashkin certainly believes that the bombings were done with the collusion, or if not, that they did it, a certain branch of the FSB, but he would never, I don't think he would ever sort of point a finger directly at Putin.
Well, his apartment was raided in 2002. What did the FSB say it was looking for?
You know, I don't, as I recall, they didn't really say what they were looking for. What they found supposedly were a few bullets, which Tropotkin maintains were planted. No gun, just bullets. And some old investigative files from when he had been working at the FSB that were left around. And he also maintains those were planted, too.
My guest is Scott Anderson, whose article, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, is in the September issue of GQ magazine. We'll take a little break and come back with more and find out why GQ was so uncomfortable about publishing this story. We're back with Scott Anderson, whose article, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, was published in the September issue of GQ magazine in this country.
Right.
We'll get into the whole matter of what happened to the story elsewhere in just a moment. You report that even John McCain in 2003 raised questions about who was behind the attacks on the apartment buildings. Have any other governments taken up serious inquiries into what happened?
You know, it's a great question. I have heard that both the British and the German intelligence agencies took a very close look at the bombings. Neither, though, nor any other countries have ever come out publicly with their findings.
You have talked to people who were there. One of the men you interviewed who lost family members in a bombing told you, they say it was the Chechens who did this, but that is a lie. It was Putin's people. Everyone knows that. No one wants to talk about it, but everyone knows it. Do you think that those accusations are common in Russia?
You know, it was very interesting going back. It was exactly a year ago. I was there on the 9th anniversary, so it was exactly a year ago now. In the immediate 2-3 years after the bombings, there were a lot of people who came out and certainly raised questions, if not accusations, and in many cases accusations that there was just something not at all right about this story.
But there are conspiracy theories about almost every major event, like the assassination of President Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, and
right.
9/11. Can be sure this story isn't just another one of them.
Well, and that is the tricky thing, especially dealing in Russia, because they sort of love conspiracy theories there. I think the problem with this one was that if you just try to look at any point of why the Chechens would have done this, what was the motive behind it, what was the MO of carrying it out, it just the idea that there was this group of Chechen bombers roaming around Moscow at a time when people were just in a state of hysteria, it just strains credulity.
And then they stopped. So you went to your editors, you thought this was an interesting story. What was their response when you proposed it to them?
They said, great, it sounds really interesting, go over and do it.
So you went to Russia, you wrote the story, presented it to your editors. How was it received?
Very well. They seemed very excited about it. They gave it more room than all magazines now are kind of cutting down space, and I was kind of pleased with the amount of space they gave it.
They gave it a wonderful presentation. It opens with a two-page spread with the title of the article and a really menacing-looking photograph of Vladimir Putin on the
right.
other page.
Right. and then all through the process of fact-checking and editing, they were very supportive of it.
When did the company's position on the story change?
That I knew of was the day before closing. It was on a Thursday. Closing the article is just all, you know, you're doing last galleys, last little touch-ups to it. And so it all wraps on Friday. And then this memo came down from the County Nest hierarchy on Thursday.
And we have obtained a copy of that memo sent on July 23rd by a County Nest attorney. And we've had somebody record the memo. Let's take a listen to a part of it.
Dear Luke, following up on our conversations, Condé Nast Management has decided that the September issue of U.S. GQ magazine, containing Scott Anderson's article, Vladimir Putin's Dark Rise to Power, should not be distributed in Russia. To that end, the following steps should be taken. 1. Subscription, newsstand, and other copies of the issue should not be sent to recipients in Russia. I've discussed this with the Condé Nast Consumer Marketing Department, and they are taking the appropriate steps. 2. Condé Nast's and GQ's public relations people should not send copies or publicize the article to recipients in Russia, the Russian press, or other Russian institutions. 3. I have advised people make sure his department does not send copies to advertisers or potential advertisers in Russia. Peter has confirmed that there are no Russian advertisers, e.g. Stolichnaya, in the September issue.
Now, he mentioned a different title for the article. Was the title changed, or did he just get it wrong?
It was changed. I mean, that's kind of the irony of it, is that the first title was the one he used in the memo. And I, including myself, I felt it was too strong. It was too accusatory. Because certainly in the article, I never point a finger directly at Putin.
You don't say that Putin actually was responsible for all of this. It's just that... there was fear of his response.
Yes,
you don't say that in the article either. But.
Right, right. I mean, as far as the bombings, I think there's no question that Vladimir Putin was the primary beneficiary. but if you're talking about the Condé Nast reaction to it, I think it was a preemptive move to. Worried about what might happen.
It's odd that at the same time we received a highlight sheet of the article sent by the GQ publicist to our show. So it wasn't being suppressed in this country. They were only concerned about Russia?
No.
Because Russians do read American magazines.
Right. No, I mean, I think what happened was that there was a bit of a conflict between GQ, the magazine, and Condé Nast, the corporation. Because also in the memo, it's not just in Russia. This article is not going to be published in any European editions of GQ. It's not going to be on the American Facebook page. It's not going to be on the Condé Nast website. So the Condé Nast, even in this country, the plan was to bury it as much as possible. And I think GQ rebelled against that.
Well, it's interesting that Rupert Murdoch has squelched articles that are critical of China because he has so much invested in China, and I think he has a satellite system as well, a communication system. But I can't imagine Condé Nast is making billions of dollars from their various Russian publications.
No, I don't think so. I think that the problem is within Russia. The press freedoms is a very, very tenuous concept there, and. Rather than just go in and sort of clumsily close down a place, they can just make your life very, very difficult.
We want to play a second part of this memo. Let's listen to it.
4. The article should not be put on the GQ website, nor on any website. Please confirm to me who will be advised of this. 5. The article should not be put on or referred to on GQ's Facebook page, Twitter account, RSS feeds, iTunes podcasts, etc., nor on any other form of social networking or new media. 6. The Condé Nast Contracts Department has been instructed not to permit the syndication of the article to any foreign Condé Nast magazines under the foreign option. 7. You should request that after rights in the article revert to Scott Anderson, he should not license or syndicate the work in any way that might lead to its publication or distribution in Russia. Signed, Jerry S. Behrens, Esquire.
Now, it's interesting, Scott. The editor of Russian GQ, Nikolai Uskov, told Echo Moskvy radio station that, and I'm quoting, "I did not receive any orders from my management not to publish." And then he added, "I can publish it if I want, but there's nothing in this article that Russian media have not been writing about for several years." So do you think that his statement contradicts point 6 in the memo that Condé Nast Contracts Department has been instructed not to permit the syndication of the article to any foreign Condé Nast magazines?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if there's usually a lag time between when something appears in, say, the American GQ and when it becomes available for foreign editions. To what the Russian GQ editor said, you know, it very well could be that this story, that certainly for a certain educated class of people in Russia, that there may not be that much new in this article. But I've never seen anywhere in any Russian newspaper or magazine, you'd have to go back to the immediate aftermath of the bombings, where anything has been done in this kind of comprehensive and detailed way.
The GQ editor-in-chief, Jim Nelson, told the New York Times something that didn't run. We have we have received it anyway. On September 5th, it said, I was drawn to the story from the beginning and thought Scott Anderson did an amazing reporting job on the piece, which is why I published it and was proud to do so. What I hope is that this will get more people to read the story, which is powerful and speaks for itself. So there are still some people in the, at least yeah, in the American edition, are perfectly happy with the story. And Murray Pearl, the chief spokeswoman for Condé Nast, declined to comment to the New York Times on any limitations that the company had placed on the article or the reasons for them. But she said, we're mindful of the laws and issues in the countries we publish in. Is this kind of coverage illegal in Russia?
No. No, it's not illegal. It's not illegal. I mean, as I said before, I think there may be certain grounds for worrying about legal repercussions. But they have very wonky libel laws in Russia that, you know, technically I think Putin or even the FSB organization could bring a libel suit. But I think that probably what they were more worried about was this kind of backdoor legal problems of having all of a sudden their offices being cited for health code violations or something.
Well, journalists in Russia do get audited and harassed, and we are seeing more and more of this sort of thing around the world.
Right.
I wonder about your thoughts about that. If an American publication does something that they think is perfectly fine here but might get them into trouble elsewhere, how much do you think they're thinking of that before they publish now?
You know, I think it's a very odd thing to do, especially with new media. I mean, the idea that a story, any story, can be quarantined to one market is really rather quaint and old-fashioned.
Anybody who reads English can probably access this on the internet.
Sure, and you can, and as a result of what the Condé Nast management did or tried to do, of course, the story, most attempts at censorship tend to backfire for that very reason, because it's so more people tend to look at it.
But in your case, I suspect that it means that you're not going to be running for Condé Nast anytime in the future. Isn't that sad?
You know, it's funny. I'm not sure that's really true. Certainly with my editors at GQ, there don't seem to be any hard feelings. I can't imagine I'm very popular among the hierarchy by talking about it publicly.
Well, Gawker.com posted a scanned version of the article and encouraged listeners to translate it, and they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They got a team of volunteer translators together. I believe they had a translation of the whole article, and the article is close to 7,000 words in a matter of hours.
You were careful not to implicate Putin, although others have. What is your, if you were just talking about your gut feeling, how involved do you think he was in all of this?
It's funny. My feelings changed over the course of the research on this. I actually think that, I mean, if I had to put a bet down, I would say he didn't know about it ahead of time.
This was the rationale for going back to war with.
Yes.
Chechnya.
Yes.
And so somebody was looking to do that, and the
right.
military was ready to go.
Right. And the military had been building up for months prior to it. They had been massing on the border. My feeling is that probably I do believe the FSB did it, and I think it was probably done at a mid-level mid-level decision was made with the knowledge that Putin had just been named prime minister 3 months before. Yeltsin was already fading from the picture. So if we do something dramatic, we have one of our own in the presidency.
I've always wondered about these renegade intelligence officers. We hear about the same sort of thing in Pakistan, mm-hmm. where members of the ISI make all sorts of decisions that then the leadership disavows.
Right.
But meanwhile, we wind up with the Taliban being given tactical support.
Right.
The same sort of thing can happen in Russia, even though Russia is a much more centralized government.
I believe so. And there's also a tradition within the Russian intelligence service. I mean, going back to the KGB days, where if a new person is coming into office, not just prime minister or party chief, but even like a governor general, that if without his knowledge, you kill a journalist or you disappear a local troublemaker. Then that new person who's come into power, they become hostage to the cover up. So you own them.
And we've seen any number of journalists killed. A listener wants to know whether you fear for your life.
I don't. I don't, because I think it would be, a little silly to try to do anything to me here. I won't be going back to Russia probably anytime soon. I'm much more concerned about Mikhail Tropotkin's welfare.
Beware of people with umbrellas who have pointy ends.
Right.
Scott Anderson's article, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, is in the September issue of GQ magazine, at least in the American edition. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. I also want to thank David Krasny for providing the voice of Condé Nast, reading that clip.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Yeah. On tomorrow's show, Franz De Waal discusses the nature of empathy and whether animals other than humans possess it. And then a Kurdish woman tells her daring story of escape from Iraq. Also, Audrey Tautou on starring in the new film Coco Before Chanel. Plus, our latest Please Explain is all about sharks. The London Low Paid Show is produced by Blake Nee Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Stephanie Bernhard, Adam Delahanty, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.